This is a podcast from RTE Radio.
This is The 11th Hour. I'm Páraic Branagh. Welcome to this week's selection from The 11th Hour podcast. A very important guest, not generally associated with County Cavan, will be giving a reading next Sunday morning in the Johnstown Centre Library. Writer, broadcaster and retired academic Germaine Greer is coming to Cavan and she joins me now on the line from the UK. Professor Greer, you're very welcome and thank you for taking part in the programme.
Thank you for asking me.
Not at all. I must read this quote. This quote seems to be the reason why you're coming to Cavan. This quote's on the door of the Central Library in Cavan. And it says, "Libraries are reservoirs of strength, grace and wit, reminders of order, calm and continuity, lakes of mental energy, neither warm nor cold, light nor dark. In any library in the world, I am at home, unselfconscious, still and absorbed." You wrote that, and it's on the library in Cavan now.
Well, I'm flattered. I'm honoured.
It's a wonderful quote, and it's a great advertisement for a library. Have libraries been a huge part in your life?
Oh, yes, I'm afraid they have. I'm still happiest in a library, and I live where I live in England because I can get to the Cambridge University Library in 20 minutes. And for me, that's a very important feeling. Because lots of the time I look about and think, I don't know the answer to that, or I haven't read that for ages, or whatever. And so off I beetle. And sometimes my happiest days are the days when I'm sitting up in the stack somewhere next to a nice big warm pipe, next to a window that shows me out over the backs, although I can't usually see the pretty part. And then I'm truly, truly happy. And I've just had a real orgy of all of that because I've just handed in a book.
Well done.
I love this book. It's called Shakespeare's Wife.
But you also did your PhD, your doctorate on Shakespeare. So you're quite an expert, really.
Well, I used to sit in the same seminars as Stephen Greenblatt. And Stephen Greenblatt has just issued a book called Will in the World. He hasn't just done it. It's about 3 years old. But it's selling on, airport bookstores. And it makes me truly cross because he doesn't scruple to say that Shakespeare detested his wife. He has no evidence for that whatsoever, except that she was 8 years older than he was and she was pregnant when they got married. And these two pretty obvious bits of information, which are practically all we have, are turned into a case against her. That, first of all, she gets dumped by Shakespeare, and then you have to say, well, she must have deserved it, she must have been awful. But in fact, I think it's just the good old misogynist tradition. And she wasn't really dumped by Shakespeare. I mean, he went back to die in her house. He could have gone anywhere else, but he didn't.
But he left her the second best bed in the house in his will.
Well, that's quite interesting because it's a very odd will. And I discuss that in my book because I think the will is lopsided. And that's partly because it's principally being drawn up to protect the marriage settlement of his daughter, Susanna. And therefore, he doesn't actually convey any papers or any books. And he makes very few personal bequests. He doesn't seem to be totally at liberty. And it's been my feeling all along. And I make a case for it. It's not entirely convincing because there's not, overwhelming evidence. But it seems to me that she was a working woman and she supported herself. And she had property of her own. And she was also a Puritan. She might not have wanted property that was acquired via the theatre. I just don't know. But I don't think she was she certainly didn't go into the almshouses and she didn't become a drain on the state. I hope she didn't have to live in New Place, which was her house, under the tutelage of her daughter, because I think it was a very dull place. They were a very dull couple. I fancy she housekept for her brother back in the farm she was born in, or else she helped her daughter run the tavern with her husband. And there were four babies there, much more fun.
But tell us, in Shakespeare's Wife, have you come to a definite conclusion on what happened? Or are you just postulating some theories on what might have happened?
Well, you see, the thing that's irritating when you read all these endless rehashings of the same old biographical data about Shakespeare is that the authors don't seem to read any social history. And we've really come ahead by leaps and bounds. We know much more about the way ordinary people lived. And they shouldn't really be so ignorant. And they assume, that Anne Hathaway did nothing until she met Shakespeare. That she was just sort of sitting around waiting for a penniless boy to set her cap at. And she must have been working. And she's, I mean, one of the things that could have happened is she could have been working for his father, because there were women employed by Glovers to sew the cut-out skins that are called tranks. That would be a not very nice story if the son of the household seduced a working girl working for his father, but it wouldn't be uncommon.
Pretty normal, really.
There speaks an Irishman.
Amongst the gentry, I meant.
Well, yes, but it's unfortunately, except that Shakespeare, you know, wasn't gentry. I mean, his father was an artisan. Shakespeare went and got himself a grant of arms, but it was pretty disgusting. It was outrageous, in fact. And everybody tries to excuse it by saying that it was for his father. But I don't think his father knew he'd even done it.
But it's quite extraordinary when we have, I remember the book at home in our own library in Connemara, The Complete Works of Shakespeare, a big volume and lots of writings, poetry, drama, and we have nothing in those writings at all describes in any detail what happened to Anne Hathaway. Isn't that extraordinary?
Well, you see, it's because scholars don't like to think about wives. And there's a big tradition that the wives of great men are always awful. So they sort of tell you, oh, Milton was unhappily married. Milton wore out three wives. I think they were the ones who had the hard time, not John Milton. I mean, two of them died in childbirth. I mean, that's kind of tough. But he's the one who's unhappily married. Oh, spare me. Likewise, they talk about Shakespeare being frustrated and lonely after he'd left his wife. Well, tough.
Well, he was working in the theatre. Nobody's ever frustrated or lonely in the theatre, are they?
Oh, well, he didn't go straight into the theatre, did he? Mm. So where did he go? We still don't know the answer to that, and we don't know whether he came home often or never or what.
That is something. Did you enjoy this mystery, this chase for information?
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I also, for example, there was I sitting thinking, now there she is. She's got a toddler, Susanna, and she's got twins. And I promise you, having twins in 1585 was a drama. Most people who had twins, the twins didn't make it. They went straight into the ground within a week. Anne keeps her twins alive, but nobody thinks that Shakespeare stuck around for long after that. I'm thinking, well, what could she have done? How did she survive? I don't believe she was kept by his parents because they couldn't keep themselves. So what did she do? What did she do? And I was thinking, well, you could make cheese, which she would have learnt to make as a shepherd's daughter, and she could, she could spin, she could card, and that wasn't badly paid, sort of pennies a day, but enough to live on. And then I thought, but what would I be doing? And I thought, I'd be knitting. And I thought, I wonder if anybody knitted in the West Midlands in 1585. So I started poking around, and out came this incredible story of how the Queen had been given a pair of knitted black silk stockings by her silk woman, Mrs. Montagu, and she had said, I'm never going to wear linen stockings again. They used to wear sewn stockings, if you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine trying to genuflect in them. And so the Queen, trotting around in her hand-knitted black silk, said, that's it, I'm never having woven hose ever again. And from then on, this industry just begins to build and build. But all the time, knitted stockings are really valuable. And you don't earn pennies if you can really knit. And you can knit in changing colours, mixed yarns. You can do fancy stitches with clocking and open sections. By the time we get to sort of 1580, stockings are high fashion, and most people are not aware that Shakespeare had three brothers, and one of them was called Gilbert, and he was a haberdasher, and he went backwards and forwards between Stratford and London, as she couldn't very well with the littlies, and I reckon they kind of got together to organise people to make haberdashery wares, including stockings.
It sounds reasonable enough. If the guy was a haberdasher and all labour was local at that time, it sounds reasonable enough, really.
And we have a lot of people leaving the land.
Of course, the whole change happening at that time.
Well, it had in Warwickshire, it was happening all through that century. But it takes us, because grain prices go through the roof, the value of land suddenly goes up, which means that all the landowners who were not close to the corporation. The townspeople were mostly Puritan, the landowners were mostly Anglican or indeed Reticent, Catholic. And they suddenly start enclosing their land and ploughing it because they want to grow grain and make money.
It's a move from tillage and getting rid of the tenant farmers. But let's go back to this quote. This comes from a book of yours, Daddy, We Hardly Knew You. That's a fascinating book. Was that where your love of libraries started, researching that book?
No, I'd spent most of my childhood in libraries. When I was 15, I used to get on the train and go up to Melbourne from the seaside suburb I lived in with a jar of pickled mussels in my briefcase for my lunch, and I would con my way in to the public library. I was actually too young to use it, but I found a way and talked my way in. And I used to just love being there. Then once I went to university, of course, it was libraries all the time, really. And still, I still love libraries.
You described growing up in a house where there was no books, no music, mm-hmm. no art. Where did you learn your? Where did your love of books come from? Your love of learning come from?
The nuns.
Irish nuns.
Yep.
Fair play to them.
Presentation. Give credit where credit is due. All the nuns who taught me really loved everything about culture. They weren't terribly well educated themselves. They weren't very well trained as teachers, but they managed to convey to me that if I learned about things like art and literature, then I had access to delight, and an innocent delight that I could indulge in any time. Of course, I remember being, when I was a bit, oh, I think I must, what was I, 15? I must be 14 when I went to the library, because when I was 15, I went through that thing of giving everything up.
Of course, vegetarian, all that.
Mortifying myself, starving myself, fainting in church because I insisted on praying with my arms held out. Then I decided, it was all because one of the nuns said to me, you know, Jermaine, you could be a great saint or a great sinner.
Right, so which of them are you?
Well, I thought about being a saint for a bit, and then I thought, oh, this is boring. And I went, there won't be anybody in heaven I really want to talk to, so I think I'll go for the sinner.
So you're stuck on the sinner's path at the moment.
Yeah, well, I don't believe in God, do I? It's a bit of a worry.
But looking back at your, while we have you in and we're talking to you, I was looking back at the female eunuch. That caused huge controversy. Looking back at your own work, would you revise that work now? Would you revise any of the ideas in that work?
No, not at all. I think it's quite a cute piece of writing. It's sort of Australian Gothic. It makes me smile the way I write. And you would know if you read that book that I'm a Shakespeare scholar, because he turns up all over the place. There are unacknowledged silent quotations. That's a very Australian thing to do. We have a great book by a writer called Furphy that's called Such Is Life by Tom Collins. He wrote it under that pseudonym. And he's the same. There's bits of submerged Shakespeare knocking around all over the place.
Let's reconnect with Ireland. You're looking forward to going to Cavan?
Of course.
I'm obliged to Professor Greer for speaking to us.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Belinda McKeown has been to two major theatre productions on the New York stage, David Hare's polemic on Iraq, The Vertical Hour, and Tom Stoppard's epic trilogy, The Coast of Utopia. The Coast of Utopia is a logistical and artistic monolith, which has been produced at the Lincoln Center in New York with a star cast that includes our own Brina O'Byrne, Billy Crudup, and Ethan Hawke. It's a trilogy. Parts 1 and 2 have opened, and Part 3 is opening tonight. Belinda McKeown is in New York, and she's seen Part 1 and 2 in the trilogy, which are called Voyage and Shipwreck. What were they about?
Well, the trilogy is set, it's a take on the 19th century historical and literary figures in Russia, just like Stoppard did in The Invention of Love, a previous play. But this time he doesn't stay in one place, he doesn't stay in Russia. He takes in really the entirety of Europe during the 19th century. The voyage opens in a sort of Chekhovian country estate, and it introduces us to the characters and makes clear from the beginning that we're going to be looking at a very large cast of characters. There are actually 44 actors in this production playing more than 70 parts. It's a group, chiefly a group of young men, idealists and romanticists who really believe they're you know, nobility, the gentry, and they are men of ideas who think that they can change Russia and can change Europe. And the play follows them over the course of the next 20 to 25 years and watches what happens to those ideals and those ideas. And some of them succeed and some of them really don't.
It has a range of characters, but also has sort of central characters that run through the three plays. People like Turgenev the poet, Bakunin the anarchist, Herzen the writer. And they stay right through the three plays.
Herzen is played by Brian F. O'Byrne. And the play opens, the very first play opens with a spectacular image of O'Byrne floating above the stage in an armchair, and it's revolving. I mean, the set is spectacular. It was designed by Bob Crowley, who's from Cork. And it makes clear, really, that, you know, that Herzen is going to be a central figure. And we don't see much of him in the first play, but in the second play, Shipwreck, it's almost entirely about him and his family. They're in exile from Russia now. They're living chiefly in Paris and in Nice. The third play, which we'll go into preview tonight, we'll see them later on in London. They're all ideas men and ideas women, but he is really the hero of the play. And O'Byrne puts in a really spectacular performance as Herzen. And I talked to him a little bit, Porrick, backstage. I talked to him a little bit about the character and how he felt, how he found out about Herzen, and how he learned some more about 19th century Russia and about the figure of Alexander Herzen.
Well, he's an extraordinary man. I had never heard of the guy before. I guess his main achievement from the outside was that he founded a magazine in London with his very good friend from childhood, a poet called Nicholas Agariov, and it was called The Bell, and that basically did lead to the emancipation of the serfs, which was 50 million people, which isn't a bad achievement for somebody. You know, they were off this social class that they could actually have the freedom to sit back and just ponder life. But actually, these were much more active, actually. The people we're talking about in the play were active and did affect change. But the fact that they enjoyed this and considered it as part of their life is something far removed from me, you know what I mean? I mean, I just, you know, check the baseball scores and have a chat with somebody about how the Mets are doing, or soccer scores at home, you know? Yeah. So it's a different approach.
So, Breen, is this your first time to work on a stop-work play?
No, actually, I worked here before at the Lincoln Center 10, 12 years ago. I did a play called Hapgood, which was directed by Jack O'Brien as well. It was the first time Jack and Tom worked together, and actually was designed by Bob Crowley, who's designed, you know, Cork Man, and who's John's brother, John Crowley, the director's brother.
To prepare for this role, I mean, you would have had to know, or at least come to know a lot about Alexander Herzen.
Yeah, well, no, obviously I hadn't a clue. I had no idea who this person was. So
tell me about the process of getting to know him.
Well, we did a strange thing. First of all, I had a week off between my last job and starting rehearsals for this, and so I decided that I'd just, on the spur of the moment, go to Moscow and St. Petersburg. So myself and actually a couple of the cast, I called around, and a couple of the cast were able to come with us, and we went to Moscow and St. Petersburg and got a, I don't know if we learned anything, but we got a flavour of both of those cities, and then came back, and these plays were really inspired by three or four different particular books that Tom had read, one of them being Herzen's biography, which is, or memoir, I should say, called My Past and Thoughts, and another book by Isaiah Berlin called Russian Thinkers. They were, and also a book by E.H. Carr called Romantic Exiles. And they were the three books that were kind of provided the spark for Tom to start writing these plays. Mm. Or play, even though there are three plays, but it's really one big play. And so I read those, you know, that was the initial the starting point for the whole thing. Mm. So
Tell me a little bit about Stop Art's language and what it's like to work with.
Well, it's difficult. It's difficult because language is only as tough as the thought process behind it, really, you know. Actually, he kind of dumps it down a bit. He's very conscious of, when you work with him, we're talking about different words and stuff, he's very conscious of things like the number of syllables within in a word and sentence, because he doesn't want to give an audience a chance to switch off, particularly when we're talking about the subject matter that we talked about, which is a lot of philosophy. Yeah. And a lot of kind of political talk as well, which can be distancing for an audience. And people speak in large paragraphs a lot of the time. It is not this, we're not accustomed to it anymore. Yeah. So dealing with that type of work is new. And because I've worked almost exclusively with new writing, thankfully, for the last long time. But writers don't really write the way Stopper does right now. Now, it is a period piece, of course.
Yeah.
But they don't write. The characters aren't as intellectually vibrant. And I'm not sure if that's, I mean, you know, he starts off the second play with two characters saying, well, what will we talk about? And you suddenly realise, wow, people used to just sit down and talk. I guess in Ireland it's a bit like caillying, you know, where people would go around to people's houses and sit down and have a chat. I mean, that might be more gossip. These people were talking.
These people are talking about ideas.
Well, they're completely, I mean, it is, the term intelligentsia was coined for these people, which was a social class of people in Russia at the time. And they were dealing with massive thoughts.
Well, of course, another aspect of the production was just the sheer enormity of the stage, and I did wonder about how difficult that was for the actors, so many of them clambering around this huge stage. So I asked Brienne what it was like being on a massive stage like that.
It's a very, very, very strange thing. The stage that we have is a thrust stage, so it's not proscenium, and it's also three quarters in the round, which makes it very difficult technically. And also because we have no solid wall sets in the behind us, as you've seen, it's a colossal stage, probably one of the biggest stages in New York. Anytime we turn back upstage, our voices get lost. So it was a huge the first probably month or two, we were all just roaring our heads off just so we could be heard. Incredibly difficult place to work.
Brienne talks there about the shows about philosophy and politics, and it's in big paragraphs. Is it manageable? Can you chew this play?
Very much so. I mean, actually, I know that it has been trimmed down a little bit from... It opened in London last year, possibly. It was, 2005. It has been trimmed, but I think that it's clear that it was never... While it's a play of discussions of ideas, and these, you know, the characters are wrestling with philosophers. Kant, you know, one week they're into Kant, and the next week it's Hegel, the next week it's Schelling. There's a great energy and pace and humour through the play, which never really allows it to become overburdened by the ideas. It's essentially, I mean, really, the play is looking at how much intellectualism can do to change life. And what happens all the time is that life, you know, life has other plans, life takes over. So we see the personal twists in these men's lives, we see the family tragedies that happen to them. So it's an intellectual play, but not, I mean, I think that one of Ben Brantley's review in the New York Times said that really you could pick up any of the intellectual weight that you needed to know about 19th century Russia, you could get from a beginning lecture on Russian literature. This is not really... it's not really a polemic play. It's too lively for that, which is amazing considering that the whole piece, which will show in Marathon from the 24th of February, is over 9 hours long. It's also visually absolutely spectacular. I mean, the opening scene of Voyage, the stage is mammoth. It looks like half the size of a football pitch when you see it first. It has this amazing revolving centre that they turn it into an ice skating rink, and they turn it into the Place de Concorde in Paris. It becomes St. Petersburg. It becomes a garden in the Russian countryside. And the play opens. It looks like there are actually over 300 serfs on stage, because, of course, the central event of the trilogy is Herzen's role in bringing about the emancipation of 50 million serfs in Russia. So when the play opens, it actually looks as though through the presence of many actors and through Bob Crowley's design, it does look as if there are hundreds and hundreds of serfs on stage, and it's really an overwhelming experience.
Part one sounds like it's set on a country estate with Ethan Hawke and Jennifer Leal and Martha Plimpton playing the sons and daughters of the family. It sounds a bit like Chekhov, Three Sisters, or one of those.
It's definitely a nod to Chekhov. But you could never mistake this for a Chekhov play. It's very much, it's a stop-art piece, you know, and to a certain extent, I think, and I'm not sure whether this has happened in the journey from London or whether it's partly due to the presence of actors like Hawke, but there is a sort of there's a slight Americanization to some of the delivery, not just the delivery, but in fact to the comedy, which, you know, really livens the thing up. At times that can seem to go too far. It felt on a couple occasions as though it had become a sort of Chekhovian sitcom. But those moments, I think, you know, the quality of the play overall really manages, you know, it's carried by the quality. The performances are excellent, and Ethan Hawke, perhaps a little bit of stage hogging on his part, I think. His character, of course, is the eventual anarchist.
The anarchist Bakunin. Michael Bakunin.
Yeah, he is a sort of attention hogging kind of guy, but I think that you can sense watching Hawke on stage that He's not as experienced as a stage actor as many of his colleagues on stage, and there is a sort of he's taking a little bit too much of the limelight on it.
He's still in the movies,
but exactly.
But it's a play of ideas, romantic, revolutionary. Is this kind of like Stoppard giving the American right wing a lesson in liberal left wing politics?
Oh, I don't know about that.
It's not that pedantic, like, it's more subtle than that.
No, I mean, I it has that sort of, it definitely has contemporary resonances. And I think, you know, to go beyond the sort of, you know, the usual tack of looking at the resonances with regard to America today and to Iraq, I mean, it has extraordinary resonances with Russia today. It's a play about a time when the press wasn't free in Russia. That makes it a play just as much about Russia today as about Russia in the 19th century. Part of the pleasure of the play is that you could go into it with a vast knowledge of Russian history, which I don't have, and I imagine you could gain great enjoyment from it. And there are a number, you know, you sense that it's full of in-jokes. You know, at one point, Bakunin comes out with the question of what is to be done, and of course that's sort of looking forward to Lenin's book of the same title, and there's sort of a laugh from certain sections of the audience who get that joke, and so on. When I spoke to Breen, he talked a little bit about how certain in the New York press, reading lists had been printed, you know, reading lists, books that you would need to read before you go into this play in order to get full enjoyment from it. But that really isn't the case. I mean, it works on several levels, and it works on the level of pure theatrical enjoyment and achievement, as well as on an ideas level.
Breena Fabern plays the main character in this trilogy, Alexander Herzen.
Well, of course, Breena Fabern is now one of the most acclaimed Broadway actors of his generation in New York, so this is by no means his first time to be in a big production, you know, and he really does steal the show, and I think his professionalism is he's really coming along with every single production that I see him in. He's a really superb actor. But I did ask him, you know, he's never really been in a production this intensive where you're rehearsing two shows and performing in one almost on the same day. And so I asked him, you know, has it ever been this intensive for him before? And he said, well, no, it hasn't. And then I asked him, well, you know, does that sort of experience change you as an actor? What kind of effect does that have on you as an actor?
This has required a discipline that has really tested me as a discipline. And, you know, I'm not quite sure I'm achieving it yet. I mean, it's difficult for me because my character goes all the way through, and yet we just finished blocking the third play 2 days ago. And so it's the first time I get to see my character in full. It's like we opened a three-act play and just put on one act each. So, you know, what I was doing in the beginning was wrong. But now I'm only discovering that now. So now I feel that once... We've all been aiming towards February 24th, which is the first day that we're going to do the trilogy. And that's going to be the first day that we get to see our play up and running as it's supposed to be. And that's the point that I think we'll know, just understand what's going on. So it's been odd going out, rehearsing in front of an audience in a lot of ways, and trying to discover stuff, but yet knowing that there's all this other stuff that you're rehearsing during the day that's going to feed back into the performance.
How long has this been going on? I mean,
5 months.
Yeah.
5 months of rehearsing and playing shows a night. Yeah. It's kind of exhausting. Thank God I don't have a life.
The other play you've been to see in New York is David Hare's The Vertical Hour, starring Bill Nye and Julianne Moore. How did this production work?
David Hare's The Vertical Hour is essentially, I think you could sum it up as a play about Iraq. It's a play about taking sides. The characters are Julianne Moore, who's an American academic, a former war correspondent who's turned academic. Her boyfriend, who's played by Andrew Scott, he's a physical healer based in America. Of course, Andrew Scott is an Irish actor. And his father, who's based in England, is played by Bill Nye. And essentially what happens is that Andrew Scott's character brings his girlfriend to visit his father on the father's country estate in England, and they spend time debating about the war and also getting into some fairly prickly personal matters. So it's not unlike The Stoppard in that it's a discussion play. You can see the influence of Shaw there. And of course you do have this sort of Chekhovian background for wallowing in ideas. And what happens is similar to what happens in The Coast of Utopia, again, life has other plans and life takes over from those ideas and complicates them even further.
Essentially, the first half is the arrival of the estranged son, Andrew Scott, with his girlfriend, but his father fancies her, and there's a bit of sexual tension set up there. Does that resolve itself, or does it go into polemical straight away?
What's good about the play is that doesn't resolve itself, and in fact, it sort of if it does anything, it saves the play from being too heavy. And I suppose that the person who really saves the play is Bill Nye. I mean, he's a well known he's an actor of great range, but he's also an actor of
the Caribbean and all that.
That's right, and Love Actually, and he's now in Notes on a Scandal. And he is an actor with great sort of comic sparkle, you know, and great kind of ironic wit. And he does sort of, you know, a lot of that wit is written into the script, but it's also part of his onstage presence. Now, the direction, Sam Mendes directed the play, and he doesn't really do justice to his actors in a certain sense, in that where there's comedy, it does at some points tend to look like stand-up comedy. Many of Bill Nye's lines, in fact, are best lines, are delivered to the audience as though he's a comic rather than an actor in a play. And that really spoiled part of the effect for me. I did find that, it, you know, in terms of its polemic, it was sort of, you know, overly verbose. It was a little, you know, the idea, the constant debate about the war is predictable. It does drag, you know, it's very black and white. Julianne Moore is the pro-war academic. Bill Nye's character, Oliver, is the anti-war, very, you know, very to the point. He really cuts her arguments to pieces. But the real pleasure of the play, as often in David Herr's plays, is in the sort of the personal complications that ensue. Of course, there is a sexual attraction between Nadia, Julianne Moore's character, and Oliver, Bill Nye's character. But there's also the sense of tension that comes from Andrew Scott's character, Philip, really resenting his father for the way that he treated his mother in what was essentially a sort of, you know, an open marriage in the 60s. I suppose that's sort of paralleling, you know, the idea of, you know, taking sides. Is it a simplistic thing to do? Is everything as simple as that? And Scott's character is interesting in that he doesn't, you know, he takes sides in the personal matter, but when it comes to the politics, he's really a silent man. He doesn't seem to have any strong opinion either way on the war, for example. And I asked him a little bit about that because I found it interesting that Herr would choose to put into a relationship with this sort of pro-war academic a character who doesn't really have anything to say for himself politically.
I think he's a really, really interesting character, very hard character to sort of pin down in rehearsal because both the characters of Bill and Julianne have very sort of extreme views of what Iraq is and what Iraq means in the war. And my character is a really, I would describe, a really good person and a fun person, but someone who, in order to make him a sort of an interesting character, he's a listener. So it's very important that, for me, it was very important that the listening quality that he possesses, it becomes sort of active, you know, as an actor, that you just, you know, because I don't think we, as, you know, human beings go around thinking I'm going to speak now or I'm not going to speak. You know, at any stage you have to be alive, even if you feel you don't have you know, you don't have a big reams of dialogue. So he's a good guy, and I think you know, so often with people who are good people, they can be dismissed as people because they don't choose to be overly garrulous, that they don't have anything to say. It's just that they feel that, you know, that what they say is important, so they're, you know, they're economic with what they say. And and I think he's a very Americanized character and a character that absolutely loves America. So from the point of view of the play, I think it's important that there's somebody who really does love America for its good, for its good qualities, you know, because the play, America certainly in the play, does come in for some criticism. Very recently I did an American play called Dying City, which was at the Royal Court in London, which was about two brothers, one of whom was an Iraqi soldier and the other whom was a sort of Broadway actor by a brilliant playwright called Christopher Shin.
Which brother were you?
I was both brothers, actually. Oh, yeah, I played identical twin brothers. And it was a two-hander. So it was, and that was very sort of similar themes. Actually, they're putting a production of it on at the Lincoln Center here in New York. But so that, and I literally finished that in July of this year. So it was really interesting because a lot of the themes are very, very similar. And I think with subject matters like these, it's only really interesting sort of dramatically for an audience if the personal and the political are sort of very even-handed, and that it's sort of seamless. Because if people feel that they're being lectured at, they just immediately sort of switch off. And all, but at the same time, you know, you have to address and not be afraid of the fact that the play, plays like Dying City, and particularly David's play, The Vertigo Era, is political. And that's what I think Broadway audiences over here are just, you know, desperate for, because there's a real shortage of plays here, any sort of plays. I mean, it's a lot of musicals here to kind of do the big business. So it's great that our show is such a big hit, you know, that people are coming to see it. Broadway audiences are very, they're not backward and coming forward, you know. So they're just tremendously grateful, you know. There's a line in it where they, where Bill Nye's character, Oliver, is asked why he didn't believe in the war from the start, and he says, well, I knew who the surgeon was going to be, so I had a fair idea what the operation was going to look like. And every single night, without fail, it gets a round of applause. They love clapping here.
Are America waking up to the politics of Iraq, or the art and politics of Iraq?
Well, we're talking about a Broadway audience, and, you know, a Broadway audience who goes, which goes to see a straight play, are essentially quite a sophisticated audience anyway, and arguably fairly liberal. So it can be hard to judge, you know. I mean, I don't know how useful a barometer a Broadway audience is for the reaction of, or for the work that theatre can do, if it can do any work at all, in gauging or in shaping the response of an American public to Iraq.
And to finish up, the performances, there's a very good cast in this play. Do the performances hold up to scrutiny?
Well, you know, Nye, he does take the show. He does. He really is the sort of star of the show. Julianne Moore doesn't, you know, it has to be said that her character is very attractive and very interesting, but she really doesn't look comfortable on stage. Again, I think she's a screen actor. She's an actor who works through facial expressions and through those sort of subtleties. And the experience of having to use her whole body and of having to navigate a whole stage seems to be difficult for her. Now, Andrew Scott is excellent. His character is in sort of a no man's land, and that also looks a little bit difficult to navigate. But it was the performance of Bill Nye with his timing and with his ability to negotiate between the two other characters that really was the success of the show for me. And I think, you know, that is the general feeling about the play. Although, you know, commercially it's been a massive success, you will often find that with a play that has a leading Hollywood star like Julianne Moore, and indeed Bill Nye, in the lineup.
According to one review I read, Bill Nye was like a gopher on the prairie, head endlessly twitching to spot an encroaching enemy. That's not the way you saw it.
Well, I would see that as a positive thing, Mark.
Belinda McKeown, thanks very much for being with us from New York.
Thanks, Warwick.
I hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the 11th Hour podcast. The 11th Hour is live on RT Radio 1, Mondays to Fridays at 11 p.m. From me, Pádraig Branagh, and the rest of the team in the 11th Hour, Slán.